the means of getting him away, but that will be a lie, of course. From a tactical point of view, it would be better to have a second man present to kill him immediately after he takes his shot, with a suppressed weapon. For the second killer, escape is far easier, since the attention of the crowd will be on the first gunman. It also alleviates the possible problem of our gunman talking to the police. The Italian police do not have a good public reputation, but that is not, strictly speaking, true. As our resident in Rome can tell you, their investigative arms are quite well organized and highly professional. Thus, it is in our interest to have our gunman eliminated at once.
But won't that suggest the involvement of an intelligence service? Andropov asked. Is it too elegant?
Bubovoy leaned back and spoke judiciously. This was what Andropov wanted to hear, and he was ready to deliver it.
Comrade Chairman, one must weigh one hazard against another. The greatest danger is if our assassin talked about how he came to be in Rome. A dead man tells no tales, as they say, and a silenced voice cannot give out information. The other side can speculate, but it is merely speculation. For our part, we can easily release information through the press sources we control about Muslim animosity toward the head of the Roman Church. The Western news services will pick it up, and with proper guidance, we can help shape the public understanding of what has taken place. The United States and Canada Institute has some excellent academicians for this purpose, as you know. We can use them to formulate the black propaganda, and then use people from the first chief directorate to propagate it. This proposed operation is not without risk, of course, but though complex, it is not all that difficult from a conceptual point of view. The real problems will be in its execution and in operational security. That's why it's critical to eliminate the assassin immediately. The most important thing is the denial of information to the other side. Let them speculate all they wish, but without hard information, they will know nothing. This operation will be very closely held, I presume.
Less than 5 people at present.
How many more? Andropov asked, impressed at Bobovoy's expertise and sang-froid. At least 3 Bulgarians. Then they will select the Turk. It must be a Turk, you see.
Why?
Though Andropov figured he knew the answer. Turkey is a Muslim country, and there is a long-standing antipathy between the Christian churches and Islam. This way, the operation will generate additional discord between the 2 religious groups. Consider that a bonus, the Sofia residents suggested.
And how will you select the assassin?
I will leave that to Colonel Strokov. His ancestry is Russian, by the way. His family settled in Sofia at the turn of the century, but he thinks like one of us. He is a Nashi, Bubovoy assured his boss, a graduate of our own academy and an experienced field operator.
How long to set this up?
It depends more on Moscow than Sofia. Strokov will need approval from his own command, but that is a political question, not an operational one. After he gets his orders, 2 weeks, perhaps as many as 4.
And the chances of success, the chairman asked.
Medium to high, I should think. The DS field officer will drive the killer to the proper place, and then kill him a moment after the mission is accomplished, before making his escape. That is more dangerous than it sounds. The assassin will probably have a pistol, and it will not be a suppressed weapon. So the crowd will be drawn to the sound. Most people will draw back, but some will leap forward into danger, hoping to detain the gunman. If he falls from a silent bullet in the back, they will still rush in, while our man, like others in the crowd, draws back. Like waves on the beach, Bubovoy explained. He could see it all happening in his mind.
Shooting a pistol is not as easy as the cinema would have us believe, though. Remember, on a battlefield, for every man killed, two or three are wounded and survive. Our gunman will get no closer than 4 or 5 meters. It's close enough for an expert, but our man will not be an expert. And then there's the complicating factor of medical care. Unless you are shot through the heart or brain, skilled surgeons can often reach into the grave and pull a wounded man back out. So, realistically, it is a 50% operation. The consequences of failure, therefore, must be taken into account. That is a political question, Comrade Chairman, Bubovoy concluded, meaning that it wasn't his ass on the line, exactly. At the same time, he knew that mission success meant generals, stars, which, for the colonel, was an acceptable gamble, with a huge upside and little in the way of a downside. It appealed to his careerism as well as his patriotism. Very well. What needs to be done? First of all, the DS operates under political guidance. The section that Colonel Strokov commands operates with few written records, but it is directly controlled by the Bulgarian Politburo. So we would have to get political authorization, which necessarily means approval from our own political leadership. The Bulgarians will not authorize their cooperation without an official request from our government. After that, it's actually a straightforward operation.
I see. Andropov went silent for half a minute or so. There was a Politburo meeting the day after tomorrow. Was it too soon to float this mission, he wondered. How difficult might it be to make his case? He'd have to show them the Warsaw letter, and they would not be the least bit pleased by it. He'd have to present it in such a way as to make the urgency of the matter plain and frightening to them. Would they be frightened? Well, he could help them along that path, couldn't he? Andropov pondered the question for a few more seconds and came to a favorable conclusion. Anything else, Colonel? It hardly needs saying that operational security must be airtight. The Vatican has its own highly effective intelligence service. It would be a mistake to underestimate their capabilities, Bubovoy warned. Therefore, our Politburo and the Bulgarians must know that this matter cannot be discussed outside of their own number. And for our side, that means no one, even in the Central Committee or the Party Secretariat. The smallest leak would be ruinous to the mission. But, at the same time, he went on, we have much working for us. The Pope necessarily cannot isolate himself, nor can he be protected as we or any other nation-state would do with such a threat to its chief of state. In an operational sense, he is actually rather a soft target. If, that is, we can find an assassin willing to risk his life to get sufficiently close to take his shot. So, if I can get authorization from the Politburo, and then we make the request for assistance from our Bulgarian brothers, and then you can get this Colonel Strokov moving, how long before it actually happens?
A month, I should think. Perhaps 2 months, but not more than that. We would need some support from Station Rome for issues of timing and such, but that's all. Our own hands would be entirely clean, especially if Strokov assists in eliminating the assassin immediately upon completion of his mission.
You'd want this Strokov fellow to act personally?
Da, Bobovoy nodded.
Boris Andreevich is not averse to getting his hands wet. He's done this sort of thing before.
Very well. Andropov looked down at his desk. There will be no written records of this operation. Once I have proper authorization, you will receive notice to proceed from my office, but only by operational code, and that is 15-8-82-666. Any complex information will be relayed by messenger or by face-to-face contact only. Is that clear?
It is clear, Comrade Chairman. Nothing gets written down except the operation number. I expect I will be flying a good deal between Sofia and Moscow, but that is not a problem.
The Bulgarians are trustworthy, Andropov asked, suddenly worried.
Yes, they are, Comrade Chairman. We have a long-standing operational relationship with them, and they are expert at this sort of thing. More than we are, in fact. They have had more practice. When someone must die, it's often the Bulgars who take care of matters for us.
Yes, Colonel Rozhdestvensky has told me that I just have no direct knowledge of it.
You could, of course, meet with Colonel Strokov any time you wish, Bobovoy suggested.
Andropov shook his head. Better that I should not, I think.
As you wish, Comrade Sherman.
That figured, Bobovoy thought. Andropov was a party man, not used to getting his hands dirty. Politicians were all the same. Bloodthirsty, but personally tidy, depending on others to carry out their nasty wishes. Well, that was his job, the colonel decided, and since politicians controlled the good things in his society, he needed to please them to get the honey from the hive. And he had as big a sweet tooth as anyone else in the Soviet Union. At the end of this mission might be general stars, a nice flat in Moscow, even a modest dacha in the Lenin Hills. He'd be glad to return to Moscow, and so would his wife. If the price of it was the death of some foreigner who was a political inconvenience to his country, well, that was just too bad. He should have been more careful about who he was offending.
Thank you for coming and for giving me your expertise, Comrade Colonel. You will be hearing from me.
Bobovoy stood.
I serve the Soviet Union, he said, and made his way through the hidden door.
Rozhdestvensky was in the secretary's room, waiting for him.
How did it go, Ilya?
I am not sure I am allowed to say, was the guarded reply.
If this is about Operation 666, then you are allowed, Ilya Fedorovich, Rozhdestvensky assured him, leading him out the door into the corridor.
Then the meeting went well, Alexei Nikolaevich. More than that, I can only say with the chairman's approval.
This might be a security test, after all, however much a friend Rozhdestvensky might be.
I told him you could be relied upon, Ilya. This could be good for both of us.
We serve, Alexei, just like everybody else in this building.
Let me get you to your car.
You can make the noon flight easily.
A few minutes later, he was back in Andropov's office.
Well? The chairman asked.
He says the meeting went well, but he will not say another word without your permission. Ilya Fedorovich, he is a serious professional, Comrade Chairman.
Am I to be your contact for the mission?
Yes, you are, Alexei, Andropov confirmed. I will send a signal to that effect.
Andropov didn't feel the need to run the operation himself. His was a big-picture mind, not an operational one.
What do you know of this Colonel Boris Strokov?
Bulgarian? The name is familiar. He's a senior intelligence officer who has, in the past, specialized in assassination operations. He has ample experience, and obviously Ilya knows him well.
How does one specialize in assassinations? The chairman asked. It was an aspect of the KGB he hadn't been briefed in on.
Well, his real work is something else, obviously, but the SD has a small group of officers with experience in this sort of thing. He is the most experienced. His operational record is flawless. If memory serves, he's personally eliminated 7 or 8 people whose deaths were necessary. Mostly Bulgarians, I think. Probably a Turk or two as well, but no Westerners that I know of.
Is it difficult to do? Yuri Vladimirovich asked.
I have no such experience myself, Rozhdestvensky admitted. He didn't add that he didn't especially want any. Those who do say that their concern is not so much in accomplishing the mission as in completing it. That is, avoiding police investigation afterwards. Modern police agencies are fairly effective at investigating murders, you see. In this case, you can expect a most vigorous investigation.
Bubovoy wants this Strokov fellow to go on the mission and then eliminate the assassin immediately afterward.
Rozhdestvensky nodded thoughtfully.
That makes good sense. We have discussed that option ourselves, as I recall.
Yes.
Andropov closed his eyes for a moment. Again, the image paraded itself before his mind. Certainly it would solve a lot of political problems.
Yes. My next job will be to get the Politburo's approval for the mission.
Quickly, Comrade Sherman, Colonel Rozhdestvensky asked, unable to contain his curiosity.
Tomorrow afternoon, I think.
Down in communications, Zaitsev had allowed his daily routine to absorb his consciousness. It suddenly struck him how mindless his job was. They wanted this job to be done by machines, and he'd become that machine. He had it all committed to memory. Which operational designator went to which case officer upstairs, and what the operations were all about. So much information slid into his mind along the way that it rather amazed him. It had happened so gradually that he'd never really noticed. He noticed now. But it was 15-8-82-666 that kept swimming around his mind.
Zaitsev, a voice asked.
The communicator turned to see Colonel Rozhdestvensky.
Yes, Comrade Colonel.
A dispatch for Resident Sofia.
He handed across the message form, properly made out.
On the machine or the pad, Comrade?
The Colonel paused for a moment, weighing the two options. He came down on the side of consistency.
The pad, I think.
As you wish, Comrade Colonel. I will have it out in a few minutes.
Good. It will be waiting for Bubovoy when he gets back to his desk.
He made the comment without thinking about it. People all over the world talk too much, and no amount of training can entirely stop them from doing so.
So, the Sofia resident was just here, Zaitsev didn't have to ask.
Yes, Comrade Colonel.
Shall I call you to confirm the dispatch?
Yes, thank you, Comrade Major.
I serve the Soviet Union, Zaitsev assured him.
Rozhdestvensky made his way back upstairs while Zaitsev went through the normal, mind-numbing routine on encryption.
Most secret, immediate and urgent. From Office of Chairman, Moscow Center. To Resident Sofia. Reference. Operational Designator 15-8-82-666.
For all future communications, your operational contact will be Colonel Rozhdestvensky, by order of the chairman. It was just a housekeeping message, but coded immediate and urgent. That meant it was important to Chairman Andropov, and the reference made it an operation, not just a query to some resident.
They really want to do it, Zaitsev realized. What the hell could he do about it?
No one in this room, no one in the entire building could forestall this operation.
But outside the building?
Zaitsev lit a cigarette. He'd be taking the metro home, as usual. Would that American be there as well?
He was contemplating treason, he thought, chillingly. The crime had a fearsome sound to it, with an even more fearsome reality. But the other side of that coin was to sit here and read over the dispatches while an innocent man was killed. And no, he could not do that.
Zaitsev took a message blank off a centimeter-thick pad of them on his desk. He set the single sheet of paper on the desk surface and wrote in English, using a number one soft pencil, "If you find this interesting, wear a green tie tomorrow." That was as far as his courage stretched this afternoon. He folded the form and tucked it inside his cigarette pack, careful to do everything with normal motions, because anything the least bit unusual in this room was noticed. Next, he scribbled something on another blank form, then crumpled and tossed it into the waste can and went back to his usual work. For the next 3 hours, Oleg Ivanich would rethink his action every time he reached in his pocket for a smoke. Every time he'd consider taking out the folded sheet of paper and ripping it to small bits before relegating it to the waste can, and then the burn bag. But every time, he'd leave it there, telling himself that he'd done nothing yet. Above all, he tried to set his mind free, to do his regular work and deliberately put himself on autopilot, trying to let the day go by. Finally, he told himself that his fate was in hands other than his own. If he got home without anything unusual happening, he'd take the folded form out of his cigarette pack and burn it in his kitchen, and that would be the end of it. About 4 in the afternoon, Zaitsev looked up at the water-stained ceiling of communications and whispered something akin to a prayer. Finally, the workday ended. He took the usual route at the usual pace to the usual metro stop, down the escalator onto the platform. The metro schedule was as predictable as the coming and going of the tides, and he boarded the carriage along with 100 others. Then his heart almost stopped cold in his chest. There was the American, standing in exactly the same place, reading a newspaper in his right hand, with his left holding on to the overhead rail, his raincoat unbuttoned and loose around his slender frame. The open pocket beckoned to him as the sirens had to Odysseus. Zaitsev made his way to the center of the rail car, shuffling between other riders. His right hand fished in his shirt pocket for the cigarette pack. He deftly removed the message blank from the pack and palmed it, shuffling about the car as it slowed for a station, making room for another passenger. It worked perfectly. He jostled into the American and made the transfer, then drew back. Zaitsev took a deep breath. The deed was done. What happened now was indeed in other hands. Was the man really an American, or some false flag from the Second Chief Directorate? Had the American seen his face? Did that matter? Weren't his fingerprints on the message form? Zaitsev didn't have a clue. He'd been careful when tearing off the form, and if questioned, he could always say that the pad just lay on his desk, and anyone could have taken a form, even asked him for it. It might be enough even to foil a KGB investigation if he stuck to his story. Soon enough, he was off the subway car and walking into the open air. He hoped nobody saw his hands shake as he lit up a smoke. Foley's highly trained senses had failed him. With his coat loose about him, he hadn't noticed any touch, except for the usual bumps associated with the subway, whether in Moscow or New York. But as he made his way off the train, he stuck his left hand into the left side pocket, and there was something there, and he knew that it wasn't something he'd placed there himself. A quizzical look crossed his face, which his training quickly erased. He succumbed to the temptation to look around for a tail, but instantly realized that, given his regular schedule, there'd be a fresh face here on the surface to track him, or most likely a series of cameras atop the surrounding buildings. Movie film was as cheap here as everywhere else in the world. And so he walked home, just as on any other day, nodded at the guard at the gate, and then made his way into the elevator, then through the door. "I'm home, honey," Ed Foley announced, taking out the paper only after the door was closed. He was reasonably certain that there were no cameras in the apartment. Even American technology wasn't that far along yet, and he'd seen enough of Moscow to be unimpressed with their technical capabilities. His fingers unfolded the paper, and then he stopped cold in his tracks. "What's for dinner?" he called out. "Come and see, Ed," Mary Pat's voice came from the kitchen. Hamburgers were sizzling on the stove. Mashed potatoes and gravy, plus baked beans. Your basic American working-class dinner. But the bread was Russian, and that wasn't bad. Little Eddie was in front of the TV, watching a Transformers tape which would keep him occupied for the next 20 minutes. "Anything interesting happened today?" Mary Pat asked from the stove. She turned for her kiss, and her husband replied with their personal code phrase for the unusual. "Not a thing, baby." That piqued her interest enough that when he held up the sheet of paper, she took it, and her eyes went wide. It wasn't so much the handwritten message as the printed header, State Security Official Communication. "Damn." His wife's lips mouthed the word. The Moscow COS nodded thoughtfully. "Can you watch the burgers, honey? I have to get something." Ed took the spatula and flipped one over. His wife was back quickly, holding a Kelly green tie. Chapter 11. Hand Jive. Of course, there was little to be done at the moment. Dinner was served and eaten, and Eddie went back to his VCR and cartoon tapes. Four-year-olds were easy to please, even in Moscow. His parents got down to business. Years ago, they'd seen The Miracle Worker on TV, in which Annie Sullivan, Anne Bancroft, taught Helen Keller, Patty Duke, the use of the manual alphabet, and they'd decided it was a useful skill to learn as a means of communicating not quickly, but quietly, and with their own shorthand. "Well, what do you think?" Ed asked Mary. "This could be pretty hot," his wife replied. "Yep. Ed, this guy works in Mercury. Their version, anyway. Wow." "More likely he just has access to their message forms," the chief of station cautioned slowly. "But I'll wear the green tie and take the same subway train for the next week or so." "Fab," his wife agreed, which was shorthand for fucking a bubba. "Hope it isn't a trap or a false flag," Ed observed. "Part of the territory, honey," MP responded. The thought of being burned didn't frighten her, though she didn't want to suffer the embarrassment. She looked for opportunities more than her husband did. He worried more. But strangely, not this time. If the Russians had made him as the chief of station, or even just as a field spook, not likely, Ed thought, they'd be total idiots to burn him like this. Not this fast, and not this amateurishly. Unless they were trying to make some sort of political point, and he couldn't see the logic of that. And the KGB was as coldly logical as Mr. Spock ever was on planet Vulcan. Even the FBI wouldn't play this loose a game. So this opportunity had to be real, unless KGB was shaking down every embassy employee it could, just to see what might fall off the tree. Possible, but damned unlikely, and therefore worth the gamble, Foley judged. He'd wear the green tie and see what happened, and be damned careful to check all the faces on the subway car. "Tell Langley?" Mary asked next. He just shook his head. "Too early for that." She nodded agreement. Next, Mary Pat mimed riding a horse. That meant that there was a chase, and they were really in the game, finally. It was as though she were afraid that her skills were going stale. Damn little chance of that, her husband thought. He was willing to bet that his wife had gone all the way through parochial school without a single rap on the knuckles, because the sisters had never once caught her misbehaving. And for that matter, Ed reflected, neither had he. "Well, tomorrow will be interesting," he told her, getting a sexy nod as a reply. The hard part for the rest of the evening was not dwelling on the opportunity. Even with their training, their thoughts kept coming back to the idea of working an agent in the Russian Mercury. It was a conceptual homer in the bottom of the ninth in the seventh game of the World Series. Reggie Jackson Foley as Mr. October. Damn. So, Simon, what do we really know about the guy? Not all that much on the personal level, Harding admitted. He's a party man, first, last, and always. His horizons have been broadened, I suppose, from his chairmanship of KGB. There's talk that he prefers Western liquor to his own vodka, and stories that he enjoys American jazz, but those could be stories floated in-house by the Center to help him appear amenable to the West. Not bloody likely, in my humble opinion. The man is a thug. His party record is not one of gentleness. One doesn't advance in that organization except by toughness, and remarkably often the high flyers are men who have crushed their own mentors along the way. It's a Darwinian organization gone mad, Jack. The fittest survive, but they prove themselves to be the fittest by smashing those who are a threat to them. Or merely smashing people to prove their own ruthlessness in the arena they've chosen. How smart is he? Ryan asked next. Another draw on the briar pipe. He's no fool. Highly developed sense of human nature. Probably a good, even a brilliant, amateur psychologist. You haven't compared him to someone from Tolstoy or Chekhov, Jack noted. Simon was a lit major, after all. Harding dismissed the thought. Too easy to do so. No. People like him most often do not appear in literature, because novelists lack the requisite imagination. There was no warning of a Hitler in German literature, Jack. Stalin evidently thought himself another Ivan the Terrible, and Sergei Eisenstein played along with his epic movie about the chap, but that sort of thing is only for those without the imagination to see people as they are, instead of being like someone else they understand. No, Stalin was a complex and fundamentally incomprehensible monster, unless you have psychiatric credentials. I do not, Harding reminded him. One need not understand them fully to predict their actions, because such people are rational within their own context. One need only understand that, or so I have always believed. Sometimes I think I ought to get Kathy involved in this work. Because she's a physician, Harding asked. Ryan nodded. Yeah, she's pretty good reading people. That's why we had the docs report in on Mikhail Suslov. None of them were shrinks, Jack reminded his workmate. So no, we know remarkably little on Andropov's personal life, Harding admitted. No one's ever been asked to delve too deeply into it. If he gets elevated to the general secretaryship, I imagine his wife will become a semi-public figure. In any case, there's no reason to think him a homosexual or anything like that. They are quite intolerant of that aberration over there, you know. Some colleague would have used it against him along the way and wrecked his career for fair. No, the closet they live in within the Soviet Union is a very deep one. Better to be celibate, the analyst concluded. Okay, Ryan thought. I'll call the Admiral tonight and tell him the Brits don't know either. It was strangely disappointing, but somehow predictable. For all that the intelligence services knew, the frequency of holes in their knowledge was often surprising to the outsiders, but not so to those on the inside. Ryan was still new enough at the game to be surprised and disappointed. A married man would be used to compromise, to letting his wife have her way on all manner of things, because every married man is pussy-whipped to one extent or another. Unless he is a total thug, and few people fit into that category. Fewer still could rise up any hierarchy that way, because in any organization you had to go along in order to get along. That was human nature. And even the Communist Party of the Soviet Union couldn't repeal that, for all their talk about the new Soviet man that they kept trying to build over there. Yeah, Ryan thought. Sure. Well, Harding said, checking his watch, I think we've served Her Majesty enough for one day. Agreed. Ryan stood up and collected his jacket off the clothes tree. Take the tube this time to Victoria Station and catch the Lionel home. The routine was getting to him. It would have been better to get a place in town and cut down the commute, but that way Sally wouldn't have much in the way of green grass to play on, and Kathy had been adamant about that. Renewed proof that he was indeed pussy-whipped, Jack thought on the way to the elevator. Well, it could have been worse. He did have a good wife to do the whipping, after all.
Colonel Bobovoy came back to the embassy on his way home from the airport. A short dispatch was waiting, which he quickly decrypted. He'd be working through Colonel Rozhdestvensky. No particular surprise there. Alexei Nikolaevich was Andropov's lapdog. And that was probably a good job, the resident thought. You just had to keep the boss happy, and Yuri Vladimirovich was probably not the demanding bastard that Bieria had been. Party people might be overly precise in their demands, but anyone who'd worked in the party secretariat doubtless knew how to work with people. The age of Stalin had indeed passed. So, it looked as though he had an assassination to arrange, Bobovoy thought. He wondered how Boris Strokov would react to it. Strokov was a professional, with little in the way of excess emotion, and less in the way of a professional conscience. To him, work was work. But the magnitude of this was higher than anything he would have encountered working for the Derzhavna Sugarnost. Would that frighten him, or excite him? It would be interesting to see. There was a coldness to his Bulgarian colleague that both alarmed and impressed the KGB officer. His particular skills could be useful things to have in one's pocket. And if the Politburo needed this annoying Pole killed, then he would just have to die. Too bad, but if what he believed was true, then they were just sending him off to heaven as a holy martyr, weren't they? Surely that was the secret ambition of every priest. Bobovoy's only concern was the political repercussions. Those would be epic, and so it was good that he was just a cutout in the operation. If it went bad, well, it wouldn't be his fault. That Strokov was the best man for the job, based on his curriculum vitae, was something no man could deny, something a board of inquiry, if any, could confirm. He'd warned the chairman that a shot, however closely taken, would not necessarily be fatal. He'd have to put that in a memo to make sure the thin paper trail on Operation 15-8-82-666 would have his formal evaluation in it. He'd draft it himself and send it by diplomatic bag to the center, and keep his own copy in his office safe,
just to make sure his own backside was properly covered. But for now, he would have to wait for the authorization to come from the Politburo. Would those old women elect to go forward with this? That was the question, and one on which he would not make a wager. Brezhnev was in his dotage. Would that make him bloodthirsty or cautious? It was too hard a question for the colonel to puzzle out. They were saying that Yuri Vladimirovich was the heir apparent. If so, here was his chance to win his spurs.
So, Mikhail Yevgenievich, will you support me tomorrow? Andropov asked over drinks in his flat.
Alexandrov swirled the expensive brown vodka in his glass.
Suslov will not attend tomorrow. They say his kidneys have failed, and he has no more than 2 weeks, the ideologue-in-waiting said, briefly dodging the issue.
Will you support me for his chair?
Need you ask, Misha? The chairman of the Committee for State Security responded.
Of course I will support you.
Very well. So, what are the chances for success in this operation you propose?
About 50-50, my people tell me.
We will use a Bulgarian officer to set it up, but for security reasons, the assassin will have to be a Turk.
A black-ass Muslim? Alexandrov asked sharply.
Misha, whoever it is will almost certainly be apprehended. Dead, according to our plan. It is impossible to expect a clean getaway in such a mission. Thus, we cannot use one of our own. The nature of the mission places constraints upon us. Ideally, we would use a trained sniper. From Spetsnaz, for example. From 300 meters, but that would mark the assassination as a killing done by a nation-state. No. This must appear to be the act of a single madman, as the Americans have them. You know, even with all the evidence the Americans had, some fools over there still blamed Kennedy on us or Castro. No. The evidence we leave must be a clear sign that we were not involved. That limits our operational methods. I think this is the best plan we can come up with.
How closely have you studied it? Alexandrov asked, taking a swallow.
It has been closely held. Operations like this must be. Security must be airtight, Mikhail Yevgenievich.
The party man conceded the point.
I suppose that is so, Yuri. But the risk of failure...
Misha, in every aspect of life there is risk. The important thing is that the operation not be tied to us. That we can assure with certainty. If nothing else, a serious wound will at least lessen Carol's ardor from making trouble for us, will it not?
It should. And half a chance of failure means half a chance of total success, Andropov reminded his guest.
Then I will support you. Leonid Ilyich will go along as well.
That will carry the day.
How long after that to get things moving?
A month or so. Perhaps 6 weeks.
That quickly? Party matters rarely sped along that well.
What is the point of taking such executive action? Isn't that what the Americans call it? If it is to take so long.
If it is to be done, better that it should be done quickly, so as to forestall further political intrigue by this man.
Who will replace him?
Some Italian, I suppose.
His selection was a major aberration.
Perhaps his death will encourage the Romans to go back to their old habits, Andropov suggested.
It generated a laugh from his guest.
Yes, they are so predictable, these religious fanatics.
So tomorrow, I will float the mission, and you will support me?
and Dropov wanted that one very clear.
Yes, Yuri Vladimirovich, you will have my support, and you will support me for Suslov's full voting seat at the table.
Tomorrow, comrade, Andropov promised.
Chapter 12. Handoff. This time the alarm clock worked and woke them both. Ed Foley rose and headed for the bathroom, quickly made way for his wife, then headed to Eddie's room to shake him loose while Mary Pat started breakfast. Their son immediately switched on the TV and got the morning exercise show that every city in the world seemed to have, starring, as everywhere in the world, a woman of impressive physique. She looked capable of waltzing through the Army's Ranger School at Fort Benning, Georgia. Because he had seen the Linda Carter series at home on cable, Eddie called her Worker Woman. Mary Pat was of the opinion that the Russian's blonde hair came out of a bottle, while Ed thought it hurt just to watch the things she did. With no decent paper or sports page to read, however, he had little choice in the matter, and semi-vegetated in front of the TV while his son giggled through the end of the Wake Up and Sweat program. It was done live, the chief of station saw. So whoever this broad was, she had to wake up at 4 a.m, and so this was probably her morning workout as well. Well, then, at least it was honest. Her husband must have been a Red Army paratrooper, and she could probably beat the shit out of him, Ed Foley thought, waiting for the morning news. That started at 6:30. The trick was to watch it and then try to figure out what was really happening in the world. Just like at home, the CIA officer thought with an early morning grumble. Well, he'd have the early bird at the embassy for that, sent by secure fax from Washington for the senior embassy staffers. For an American citizen, living in Moscow was like being on a desert island. At least they had a satellite dish at the embassy so they could download CNN and other programming. It made them feel like real people. Almost. Breakfast was breakfast. Little Eddie liked Frosted Flakes. The milk was from Finland because his mother didn't trust the local grocery store, and the foreigners-only store was convenient to the compound. Ed and Mary Pat didn't talk much over breakfast, in deference to the bugs that littered their walls. They never talked at home about important matters, except via hand code, and never in front of their son, because little kids were incapable of keeping secrets of any kind. In any case, their KGB surveillance people were probably bored with the Foleys by now, which they'd both worked hard at, inserting just enough randomness in their behavior to make them look like Americans. But a considered amount. Not too much. They'd planned it out carefully and thoroughly at Langley, with the help of a tame KGB second chief directorate defector. Mary Pat had her husband's clothes all laid out on the bed, including the green tie to go with his brown suit. Like the president, Ed looked good in brown, his wife thought. Ed would wear a raincoat again, and he would keep it unbuttoned and loose around his body, should another message be passed, and his senses would be thoroughly sandpapered all day. "What are your plans for the day?" he asked Mary Pat in the living room. "The usual. I might get together with Penny after lunch." "Oh. Well, say hello for me. Maybe we can get together for dinner later this week." "Good idea," his wife said. "Maybe they can explain rugby to me." "It's like football, honey. Just the rules are a little goofy," the station chief explained. "Well, we'll have to keep the reporters happy." "Right," Mary Pat laughed, working her eyes at the walls. "That guy from the Boston Globe is such an ass." Outside, the morning was pleasant enough. Just a hint of cool air to suggest the approach of autumn. Foley walked off toward the station, waving at the gate guard. The guy on morning duty actually smiled once in a while. He'd clearly been around foreigners too much, or had been trained to do so by KGB. His uniform was that of the Moscow militia, the city police, but Foley thought he looked a little too intelligent for that. Muscovites thought of their police as a rather low form of life,
and such an agency would not attract the brightest of people. The couple blocks to the metro station passed quickly. Crossing the streets was reasonably safe here, far more so than in New York, because private cars were pretty rare. And it was a good thing. Russian drivers made the Italians look prudent and orderly. The guys driving the ubiquitous dump trucks must all have been former tank crewmen, judging by their road manners. He picked up his copy of Pravda at the kiosk and took the escalator down to the platform. A man of the strictest habits, he arrived at the station at exactly the same time every morning, then checked the clock hanging from the ceiling to make sure. The subway trains ran on an inhumanly precise schedule, and he walked aboard at exactly 7:43 a.m. He hadn't looked over his shoulder. It was too far into his residency in Moscow to rubberneck like a new tourist, and that, he figured, would make his KGB shadow think that his American subject was about as interesting as the kasha that Russians liked for breakfast, along with the dreadful local coffee. Quality control was something the Soviets reserved for their nuclear weapons and space program, though Foley had doubts about those, based on what he'd seen in this city, where only the metro seemed to work properly. Such a strange combination of casual klutz and German-like precision they were. You could tell how well things worked over here by what they were used for, and intelligence operations had the highest priority of all, lest the Soviets' enemies find out not what they had, but what they didn't have. Foley had Agent Cardinal to tell him and America what the Soviet Union had in the military realm. Generally, it was good stuff to learn, but that was mainly because the more you learned, the less you had to worry. No, it was political intelligence that counted most here, because as backward as they were still big enough to cause trouble if you couldn't counter them early on. Langley was very worried about the Pope at the moment. He'd evidently done something that might be embarrassing to the Russians, and Ivan didn't like being embarrassed in the political field any more than American politicians. Just that Ivan didn't go running off to the Washington Post to get even. Ritter and Moore were very concerned about what Ivan might do, and even more worried about what Yuri Andropov might do. Ed Foley didn't have a feel for that particular Russian. Like most in CIA, he knew the guy only by his face, name, and his evident liver problems. That information had leaked out through a means the station chief didn't know. Maybe the Brits. If you could trust the Brits, Ed cautioned himself. He had to trust them, but something kept making the hackles on his neck get nervous about them. Well, they probably had doubts about CIA. Such a crazy game this was. He scanned the front page. Nothing surprising, though the piece on the Warsaw Pact was a little interesting. They still worried about NATO. Maybe they really did worry about having the German army come east again. They were certainly paranoid enough. Paranoia had probably been invented in Russia. Maybe Freud discovered it on a trip here, he mused, lifting his eyes for a pair tracking him. No. None, he decided. Was it possible that the KGB wasn't tracking him? Well, possible, yes, but likely, no. If they had a guy, more likely a team, shadowing him, the coverage would be expert. But why put expert? But why put expert coverage on the press attaché? Foley sighed to himself. Was he too much of a worrier, or not paranoid enough? And how did you tell the difference? Or might he have exposed himself to a false flag operation by wearing a green tie? How the hell do you tell? If he was burned, then so was his wife, and that would put the brakes on two very promising CIA careers. He and Mary Pat were Bob Ritter's fair-haired pair, the varsity, the young all-pro team at Langley, and it was a reputation that had to be both protected carefully and also built upon. The President of the United States himself would read their take and maybe make decisions based on the information they brought in. important decisions that could affect the policy of their country. The responsibility was not something to dwell on. It could drive you nuts, make you too cautious, so cautious that you never accomplished anything. No, the biggest problem in the intelligence business was in drawing the line between circumspection and effectiveness. If you leaned too far the one way, you never got anything useful done. If you went too far the other way, then you got yourself burned, and your agents. And over here, that meant virtual certain death for people for whose lives you were responsible. It was a dilemma fit to drive a man to drink. The metro stopped at his station, and he went out the door, then up the escalator. He was pretty sure that nobody had fished in his pocket. On the street level, he checked. Nothing. So whomever it was, either he only rode the afternoon train, or the chief of station had been made by the opposition. It would give him something to worry about all day. "This one's for you," Dobrik said, handing it over. "From Sofia." "Oh?" Zaitsev responded. "It's in the book. Your eyes only, Oleg Ivanich," the night duty officer said. "At least it's short." "Ah," Zaitsev said, taking the message and seeing the header. 15-8-82-666. So they figured that with a number instead of a name, the header didn't need to be encrypted. He didn't react or say anything further. It just wasn't done. Surely Kolya wondered about it. It was the office sport in communications, wondering about the things one couldn't read. This message had come in just 40 minutes after his departure. "Well, something to start my watch with. Anything else, Nikolai Konstantinovich?" "Nope. Aside from that, you have a clean desk." Dobrik was an efficient worker, whatever faults he might have had. "And now I am properly relieved of duty. At home, I have a fresh bottle of vodka." "You should eat first, Kolya," Zaitsev warned. "That's what my mother says, Oleg. Perhaps I'll have a sandwich with my breakfast," he joked. "Sleep well, Comrade Major. I relieve you," Zaitsev said as he took his seat. 10 minutes later, he had the brief dispatch decrypted. The Sofia resident acknowledged that Colonel Rozhdestvensky was his point of contact for Operation 15-8-82-666. So, that T was properly crossed, and 15-8-82-666 was a full-fledged operation now. He tucked the decrypted message into a manila envelope, sealed it, and then dripped hot wax on the seal. "They're really going to do it," Oleg Ivanovich told himself with a frown. "What do I do now?" Work his usual day, and then look for a green tie on the metro home. And pray he saw it, or pray he didn't. Zaitsev shook the thought off and called for a messenger to hand-deliver the dispatch to the top floor. A moment later, a basket full of dispatches landed on his desk for processing. "Ouch," Ed Foley said aloud at his desk. The message, a lengthy one, came from Ritter and Moore, speaking for the president. He'd have to rattle some serious bushes for this. Station Moscow didn't have a written list of agents, even by code names, and even in Foley's office safe, which in addition to a combination had a two-phase alarm built in, a keypad on the outside, and one on the inside with a different code, which Foley had set himself. The embassy's marines had orders to respond to either alarm with drawn weapons, since the contents of this safe were about the most sensitive documents in the whole building. But Foley had the names of every Russian citizen who worked for the agency hard cut into his eyelids, along with their specialty areas. 12 such agents were currently operating. They'd just lost one the week before he'd arrived in Moscow. Burned. No one knew how, though Foley was concerned that the Russians might have a mole in Langley itself. It was heresy to think it, but as CIA tried to do it to KGB, so KGB tried to do it to CIA. And there was no referee on the playing field to let the players know what the score was. The lost agent, whose code name had been Sousa, was a lieutenant colonel in the GRU, and had helped identify some major leaks in the German Defense Ministry and other NATO sources, through which KGB had gotten political-military intelligence of a high order. But that guy was dead. Still breathing, perhaps, but dead even so. Foley hoped they wouldn't load the guy alive into a furnace, as had been done with another GRU source back in the 1950s. Rather a cruel method of execution, even for the Russians under Khrushchev, and something that had kept his case officer awake for a very long time, the COS was sure. So they'd have to get two, maybe three of their agents working on this one. They had a good guy in KGB and another in the Party Central Committee. Maybe one of them might have heard about a possible operation against the Pope. Damn, Foley thought. Are they that crazy? It required a considerable stretch of his imagination. An Irishman by ancestry and Roman Catholic by education and religious affiliation, Ed Foley had to make a mental effort to set aside his personal thoughts. Such a plot was beyond the pale, perhaps, but he was dealing with people who didn't recognize the concept of limits, certainly not from any outside agency. To them, God was politics, and a threat to their political world was like Lucifer himself challenging the order of heaven. Except that the simile only went so far. This was more like Michael the Archangel challenging the order of hell. Mary Pat called it the belly of the beast, and this one was one nasty fucking beast. "Daddy!" Sally exclaimed, waking up with her usual smile. He guided her to the bathroom and then downstairs, where her oatmeal was waiting. Sally still wore her bunny rabbit sleepers, with feet and a long zipper. This one was yellow, and it was the largest size, and her feet were stretching it. She'd have to change to some other sleepwear soon, but that was Kathy's department. The routine was set. Kathy fed little Jack, and halfway through, her husband set down his paper and headed upstairs to shave. By the time he was dressed, she was finished with her duty and went off to get cleaned up and dressed while Jack burped the little guy and got him into his socks to keep his feet warm, and also to give him something to pull off so that he could see if the feet tasted the same as they had the previous day, which was a newly acquired skill. Soon the doorbell rang, and it was Margaret Vanderbeek, soon followed by Ed Beaverton, which allowed the parents to escape off to work. At Victoria Station, Kathy kissed her husband goodbye and headed for the tube station for the ride to Moorfields, while Jack took a different train to Century House, and the day was about to start for real.
"Good morning, Sir John."
"Hey, Bert." Ryan paused. Bert Canderton had Army written all over him, and it was time to ask. "What regiment were you?"
"I was Regimental Sergeant Major of the Royal Green Jacket, sir."
"Infantry?"
"Correct, sir."
"I thought you guys wore redcoats," Ryan observed.
"Well, that's your fault. You Yanks, that is. In your Revolutionary War, my regiment took so many casualties from your riflemen that the colonel of the regiment decided a green tunic might be safer. It's been that way ever since."
"How did you end up here?"
"Oh, I'm waiting for an opening at the tower to be a yeoman warder, sir. Should have a new red coat in a month or so, they tell me."
Canderton's rent-a-cop blouse had some service ribbons on it, probably not for brushing and flossing his teeth, and a regimental sergeant major in the British Army was somebody, like a master gunnery sergeant in the Marine Corps.
"I've been there. Been to the club they have," said Ryan.
"Good bunch of troops."
"Indeed. I have a friend there, Mick Truelove. He was in the Queen's Regiment."
"Well, Sir Major, keep the bad guys out," Ryan said, as he worked his card into the electronic slot that controlled the entry gate.
I will do that, sir, Canterton promised.
Harding was at his desk when Ryan came in. Jack hung his jacket on the tree.
Come in early, Simon.
Your Judge Moore sent a fax to Baz last night. Just after midnight, as a matter of fact.
Here.
He handed it across.
Ryan scanned it.
The Pope, huh?
Your president is interested, and so is the PM, as it happens, Harding said, relighting his pipe. Basil called us in early to go over what data we have.
Okay, what do we have?
Not much, Harding admitted.
I can't talk to you about our sources.
Simon, I'm not dumb. You have somebody in close, either a confidant of a Politburo member or someone in the party secretariat.
He's not telling you anything.
Ryan had seen some very interesting take in here, and it had to have come from somebody inside the big red tent.
I can't confirm your suspicion, Harding cautioned. But no, none of our sources have given us anything. Not even that the Warsaw letter has arrived in Moscow, that we know it must have.
So, we don't know jack shit.
Simon nodded soberly.
Correct.
Amazing how often that happens.
It's just a part of the job, Jack.
And the PM has her panties in a wad.
Harding hadn't heard that Americanism before, and it caused him to blink twice.
So it would seem.
So what are we supposed to tell her? She damn sure doesn't want to hear that we don't know.
No. Our political leaders do not like to hear that sort of thing.
Neither do ours, Ryan admitted to himself.
So how good is Basil at a song and dance number?
Quite good, actually.
In this case, he can say that your chaps do not have very much either.
Ask other NATO services?
Harding shook his head.
No.
It might leak out to the opposition.
First, that we are interested, and second, that we don't know enough.
How good are our friends?
Depends. The French SDECE occasionally turns good information, but they do not like to share.
Neither do our Israeli friends. The Germans are thoroughly compromised. That Marcus Wolf chap in East Germany is a bloody genius at this business. Perhaps the best in the world, and under Soviet control. The Italians have some talented people, but they, too, have problems with penetration. You know, the best service on the continent might well be the Vatican itself. But if Ivan is doing anything at the moment, he's covering it nicely. Ivan is quite good at that, you know.
So I've heard, Ryan agreed. When does Basil have to go to Downing Street?
After lunch?
3 this afternoon, I understand.
And what will we be able to give him?
Not very much, I'm afraid. Worse, Basil might want me with him.
Ryan grunted.
That ought to be fun.
Met her before?
No, but the PM has seen my analyses. Baz says she wants to meet me.
He shuddered.
It'd be much better if I had something substantive to tell her.
Well, let's see if we can come up with a threat analysis, okay?
Jack sat down. What exactly do we know?
Harding handed a sheaf of documents across. Ryan leaned back in his chair to pick through them.
You got the Warsaw letter from a Polish source, right?
Harding hesitated, but it was clear he had to answer this one.
That is correct.
So nothing from Moscow itself? Jack asked.
He shook his head.
No. We know the letter was forwarded to Moscow, but that's all.
We're really in the dark, then.
You might want to have a beer before you go across the river.
Harding looked up from his notes.
Why, thank you, Jack. I really needed to hear that bit of encouragement.
They were silent for a moment.
I work better on a computer, Ryan said.
How hard is it to get one in here?
Not easy. They have to be tempest-checked to make sure someone outside the building cannot read the keystrokes electronically. You can call administration about it. But not today, Ryan didn't say aloud. He'd learned that the bureaucracy at Century House was at least as bad as the one at Langley, and after a few years of working in the private sector, it could drive him to distraction. Okay. He'd try to come up with some ideas to save Simon from getting a new asshole installed in his guts. The Prime Minister was a lady, but in terms of demands, Father Tim at Georgetown had nothing on her. Oleg Ivanich got back from lunch at the KGB cafeteria and faced facts. Very soon he would have to decide what to say to his American and how to say it. If he was a regular embassy employee, he would have passed the first note along to the CIA chief in the embassy. There had to be one, he knew, an American resident whose job it was to spy on the Soviet Union, just as Russians spied on everyone in the world. The big question was whether they were spying on him. Could he have been doubled by the second chief directorate, whose reputation would frighten the devil in hell himself? Or could this ostensible American have been a Russian bearing a false flag? So, first of all, Oleg had to make damn sure he was dealing with the real thing. How to do that? Then it came to him. Yes, he thought. That was something KGB could never bring off. That would ensure that he was dealing with someone able to do what he needed done. No one could fake that. In celebration, Zaitsev lit up another cigarette and went back into the morning dispatches from the Washington Residentura. It was hard to like Tony Prince. The New York Times correspondent in Moscow was well regarded by the Russians, and as far as Ed Fo-